This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, January 30, 2003. From Pacifica Station WBAI in New York City, I'm Deepa Fernandes. Will public opinion in Britain stop Tony Blair's march to war with the Bush administration? And the INS enters its third phase of what it calls special registration for men from Muslim countries. We look at the latest roundups and travel to India to speak with the deported. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Jackson Allers with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. 8 European nations vote to support the U.S. military campaign into Iraq. Patrick Beckett reports from Copenhagen, Denmark.
The governments of Spain, Portugal, Italy, the United Kingdom, Czech Republic, Hungary, Poland, and Denmark signed the statement. The 8 countries issued a warning that the UN Security Council will lose credibility if it does not support an attack on Iraq. In contrast, France and Germany are calling for a second UN resolution before any action is taken. The division among European countries was highlighted even more when it was revealed that France and Germany were not even invited to sign the declaration of support for the U.S. position on Iraq. In related news, the European Parliament passed a non-binding resolution stating that any preemptive strike by the U.S. and its allies against Iraq would be a violation of international law. The Parliament does not believe that recent evidence presented by UN weapons inspectors justifies military action. In Copenhagen, I'm Patrick Beckett for Free Speech Radio News.
Bush judicial nominee heads for a Senate vote. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch scheduled a single hearing to examine 3 controversial nominees to lifetime seats on the Federal Appeals Court today. This single hearing for multiple nominees breaks a bipartisan agreement dating back to the 1980s to examine such nominees individually. Chairman Hatch also called for a new hearing for Patricia Owens and Charles Pickering, 2 appeals court nominees that were rejected last year. Peter Montgomery, Communication Director for People for the American Way, believes neither candidate merits a second look.
These are people that had extensive public hearings on their records. They lost. They were rejected by the committee for good reason. The president has brought them back, and Orrin Hatch has actually said that he's going to give them more hearings.
Hatch also forced a committee vote on Miguel Estrada today, another controversial nominee seeking to become the first Hispanic on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia.
New revelations of corporate malfeasance at Kmart. John Anderson of the Workers' Information News Service has more.
Going out of business sales begin today at more than 310 Kmart stores. 35,000 workers will be unemployed when the closures are completed in March, bringing the total number of Kmart employees laid off in the last year up to 67,000. Meanwhile, a new report prepared by the company blames gross mismanagement by a group of executives for the company's implosion. These executives reportedly referred to themselves as the frat boys and did at least $100 million worth of damage to Kmart in the year before it declared bankruptcy. Not only did the executives raid the cookie jar with a series of extravagant raises and self-approved personal loans from company funds, but they also failed to pay vendors for delivered merchandise and used company planes for personal junkets. The report also notes 4 former Kmart executives invoked the Fifth Amendment during interviews with corporate and FBI investigators. With the Workers' Independent News Service, I'm John Anderson for Free Speech Radio News.
Religious groups in Pakistan call for fingerprinting of U.S. citizens. Nusrat Malik has this story.
Pakistan's religious right called for the fingerprinting of U.S. citizens, a boycott of U.S. products, and compulsory AIDS testing of U.S. visitors yesterday. A coalition of Islamic parties called the United Action Front that won unprecedented support in Pakistan's fall elections, running on an anti-American platform, presented its demand in a list to the government and threatened nationwide demonstrations to push for them. Interior Ministry spokesman Iftikhar Ahmed said these demands were out of the question. But the United Action Front says that new U.S. immigration guidelines that require citizens of Pakistan and other countries living in the U.S. to be fingerprinted and photographed by immigration agents are the reasons for the new demands. Officials of the Pakistan government, too, have complained about the new U.S. immigration policies. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Nusrat Malik.
Israeli soldiers closed 2 TV stations and a radio station in the West Bank town of Hebron. Awad Duabes has more from Ramallah a day after Ariel Sharon's re-election.
Nothing changed for Palestinians after the victory of Ariel Sharon and the Likud party in the Israeli elections, as Sharon refused to meet with Palestinian President Yasser Arafat. Meanwhile, the Israeli Defense Forces killed 2 Palestinians and injured 8 others, including 2 girls, in the city of Tulkarem this evening. And while Palestinians in Tulkarem reacted to the killings, Israeli forces bulldozed the central market area in the West Bank town of Hebron. Palestinian officials in Hebron say this measure aimed at expanding the H2 area, which was placed under Israeli authority in the Hebron Protocol signed between the PLO and Israel in 1996. Around 450 Jewish settlers live in the city of Hebron that counts around 220,000 Palestinian inhabitants. The counselor of Palestinian President Yasser Arafat, Nabil Aburdeni, said that the new Israeli government has to choose between peace or confrontation and insisted that only peace talks can put an end to the cycle of violence in the Middle East. Palestinians also buried three victims who were killed by the Israeli army in the city of Jenin and in the Gaza Strip in the last 2 days. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Al Davis reporting from Ramallah.
And I'm Jackson Allers for Free Speech Radio News.
A report released this week in London's Observer newspaper highlighted that multinational oil corporations such as Chevron, Exxon, BP and Shell doubled their imports of oil from Iraq from 500,000 barrels in November to 1 million barrels per day to solve the apparent problem of reduced oil imports from Venezuela. Opponents of a war against Iraq say this shows a true aim of military action, citing that Iraq has the world's second largest proven reserves of oil, some 112 billion barrels, according to the US Department of Energy. Meanwhile, tomorrow, President Bush and British Prime Minister Tony Blair get together for talks about military action in Iraq. With both countries intent on military action, preventing attack could come down to public opinion. Anastasia Kershaw reports from London about the pressure bearing upon Tony Blair to stop being Bush's main supporter.
Prime Minister Tony Blair is in Washington to discuss war, but back home he leaves his own country in conflict. In Britain, most people are against military action without the backing of the UN. Politicians are angry. One of the leading lights is Labour's George Galloway, who's taken a prominent stance against action and speaks his mind.
Well, any sensible person would want the inspectors, whom we demanded for years should have access, unfettered, free access to Iraq, that these inspectors should be allowed to continue their work.
The British public, with their opinion led by the media, think similar things.
We're all getting dragged along this road far too rapidly.
Because we don't want to lose any more sons and fathers and... No.
Someone else who agrees with these sentiments is Glenda Jackson, the Oscar-winning actress, now turned Labour politician, who opposes the conflict.
Public opinion in this country is at the moment running at 81% of people opposed to a war in Iraq without evidence that he has weapons of mass destruction and without a second mandate from the United Nations. So the government, in a somewhat half-hearted way, began a propaganda programme attempting to link Saddam Hussein with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda. And it seems to me the major shift that has taken place as far as a British government's thinking is concerned is that they are apparently perfectly prepared to become the aggressor when there is no hard evidence that those whom we intend to attack offer a real and immediate threat to us and will engage willingly in a war that will surely be both illegal and immoral.
After months of speculation, the word oil springs to many people's minds, that this war is not about morals or terrorism, but about the national purse.
Certainly there is a sizable body of opinion in this country that believes the American rush to war is based less on making the world a safer place, but ensuring that there is sufficient oil in the future for what is the most wasteful nation on the face of the earth, namely the United States, as far as the use of non-renewable fuels are concerned.
The government denies this standpoint, but Galloway agrees it's about economics.
The reality is the Bush administration, right-wing, born-again, fundamentalist, Bible-thumping, hawkish, aggressive, is determined not on eliminating weapons of mass destruction, for they are amongst the people who supply weapons of mass destruction to the world, but to dominate and occupy physically the Arabian Gulf for its own selfish economic and strategic reasons.
A quarter of the British military are going to the Gulf. Terrorism has been a threat, but as in America, there's uncertainty about why we're going to war and what will happen. Galloway says it's hypocrisy.
We ourselves sit on a mountain of weapons of mass destruction. We in Britain were the first people to use chemical weapons in Iraq against, believe it or not, the Kurds. So the hypocrisy in Britain stinks, but in the United States, it's beyond stinking. Indeed, some of the people still in the White House today, or around the White House today, people like Henry Kissinger, are amongst the greatest war criminals that the world has ever seen, precisely for their illegal bombardment of Vietnam and Cambodia and their use of chemical weapons against the people there who lost 2 million of their civilians in that war. And the deformed babies are still being born on the Ho Chi Minh Trail in Vietnam today.
Support is something Blair has given Bush in abundance since 11/9. But why is he doing it?
There are some who believe that Mr. Blair has been trying to slow the rush to war, nudge the Bush administration into the United Nations process, and thus keep open the possibility of a peaceful resolution to this conflict. I take a different view. It's my view that Blair has been in on this from the start. I believe that all he's been trying to do is help George W. Bush window dress this affair more decoratively. Because if we go over the cliff to the war, then either Blair was a fool or he was a knave. And I'm not too happy, and I don't think the British people are, at having a fool or a knave as our Prime Minister.
In Baghdad, citizens may fear for their future, but many Londoners are concerned about the power of President George W. Bush. This is Anastasia Kershaw calling from London for Free Speech Radio News.
Former South African President Nelson Mandela issued a stinging criticism of US President George Bush, saying that the only reason Bush is pushing so hard for war is to gain control of Iraqi oil. Mandela called the US stance on Iraq, quote, arrogant, saying a war would cause, quote, a Holocaust. Mandela is not the only Nobel laureate to publicly oppose the United States and Great Britain. Earlier this week, 41 Nobel laureates signed a declaration denouncing a unilateral US military campaign into Iraq, saying it would undermine the security of the United States. This as thousands of anti-war protesters took to the streets again in over 100 cities and towns nationwide last night. And as FSRN's Dave Lippman files this report from Indianapolis, community organizing against a military campaign into Iraq is growing in smaller cities and towns across the US.
No Iraq war! No! A varied crew of demonstrators marched and rallied in the Indianapolis snow last night in protest of George Bush's speech to Congress on Tuesday. Indianapolis has no particular reputation for anti-war activity. If anything, it could be considered bedrock conservative. But some of those conservatives are now in the streets with the peace movement, which brought out 700 people on January 18th and is hoping for twice that many on February 15th. Law professor Mary Carter Mitchell offered a rebuttal to President Bush's State of the Union address.
We stand today with the 41 Nobel Prize laureates who called on you to give peace a chance. We stand, ironically, with Stormin' Norman, who says he's scared by your military leadership and thinks we need to give peace a chance. We stand with the report of the inspectors, whose message was somewhat distorted in your speech last night, but which I have read. And they said, give peace a chance.
Harold Donley, who served in the Marine Corps in Vietnam and was twice wounded there, said today's military tactics compare unfavorably with the My Lai massacre.
It's become an acceptable tactic. If you are a moral person, this next war is going to lead to the same type of thing. It's going to be a stain on the soul of the nation and on the soul of every citizen in that nation who does not protest against this war.
Three students from Cathedral High School were attending their first peace march. They were critical of George Bush's logic.
He tried to make the easy transfer from Osama to Saddam. It was something that was unfinished from his father's, and this will sort of finish the legacy, I think, for him.
The fact that his human rights abuses took place while he was under our tutelage, pretty much. We gave him those weapons
exactly.
After he did all those things to the Kurdish people. It's just ridiculous. We just need a scapegoat. It's killing people for crimes that they have yet to commit. In the State of the Union address last night, where he was pretty much bragging about killing suspected terrorists. I mean, I thought, and at the same time, he dared to mention American justice. How's it just to kill someone before they've even had a trial?
65-year-old Tim McGinty was also marching for the first time.
We're going to kill a lot more of them than they're going to kill us, innocent people. It's going to be a total chaos over there. And they're not going to care for us being there no matter what they think of Sodom.
The protesters are not without their critics.
Everybody I know through the service can't wait to go over there and kill some arid bastards. They can't wait to go over there and kill them.
I said we're going to invade their country and we're going to kill their leaders and we're going to steal their freaking oil for imperialism.
Indy's peace groups have begun to take the message to people where they live, on the freeways, through Operation Overpass, a four-day-a-week banner drop on overpasses all around this sprawling city. The mixture of tactics, viewpoints, and backgrounds in a middle American city reveals something long absent from the national scene, a culture of dissidents widespread enough to command respect, maybe not from the White House, but across disparate sectors of society. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Dave Lippman in Indianapolis.
The British government has turned up the heat on firefighters as the latest in a series of 48-hour strikes got underway. The Deputy Prime Minister wants to push through new legislation allowing the government to step in and force the firefighters' union to accept a pay deal. Charlotte Parsons files this report from London.
Unions are calling it a declaration of war. The British government has threatened to step in and impose a pay deal on striking firefighters. There is even talk of passing new laws making it illegal for fire service workers to take industrial action. Deputy Prime Minister John Prescott threw down the gauntlet as a 48-hour strike entered its second day. Firefighters are set to return to the picket lines when the next walkout begins on Saturday.
As a matter of priority, I will introduce legislation in the public interest to take new powers of direction over the fire service. These powers will hopefully bring a new, much-needed sense of reality into future negotiations. I will draw on the provisions in the Fire Service Act of 1947, which were repealed in 1959. Those provisions allowed the Secretary of State to specify the pay, terms, and conditions of the fire service.
The Deputy Prime Minister wants the power to force firefighters to accept a pay and modernization package if no settlement is reached by May. To firefighters, modernization is just another word for job cuts. Up to 10,000 jobs could be at risk, say the unions. Untrue, says Safety Minister Nick Rainsford. He accuses the union of playing with public safety and money.
Once again, they're wrong. They've indulged in scaremongering and putting out completely inaccurate figures to try and frighten people and to gain support for their doomed cause. Frankly, the only way this issue is going to be resolved is through discussions about how the fire service can be modernised, how we can get a safer, better fire service. This is what modernisation means. It is astonishing that the Fire Brigades Union won't begin to discuss these sensible changes that will produce a better fire service, a safer fire service, and will finance a significant pay increase for firefighters.
This afternoon, top labour movement leaders met in London to discuss the conflict. They hope to hold urgent talks with the government sometime soon. The dispute has become increasingly acrimonious since talks between the union and their employers broke down last week. Britain's firefighters were seeking a 40% pay increase, which would raise the top salary to about $49,000 a year. That's still less than a subway driver earns. But the employers say they can't afford to pay it. Fire Brigade's union leader Andy Gilchrist blames the government for the breakdown of negotiations.
We've had the most unhelpful of interventions from government. And what we've seen is the employers sliding backwards, it seems to me, in terms of what they're prepared to offer firefighters.
On Tuesday, John Prescott told members of Parliament that he did not believe the Fire Brigades Union seriously wanted a negotiated settlement. But ordinary firefighters on the picket line say that's all they want.
We know that the future depends on us, and we're prepared to stand up and say, no, this is what we want for the people that we serve. He's got the money to pay out and work with us to have a modern fire service for the future with a fair pay for the people who work within it.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Charlotte Parsons in London.
With the detention this week by INS officials of a prominent Pakistani editor, a visiting scholar to the conservative Brookings Institute, a greater mainstream spotlight has been shed on the ever-increasing ethnic profiling by the Justice Department and the INS. This as the INS began its third wave of special registration for immigrants from Muslim nations this past January 13. The exit-entry registration system is supposed to prevent terrorism by keeping track of foreign nationals once they enter the United States. But as Adam Saitanidis reports from Chicago, ordinary Pakistanis are afraid that they'll be caught up in the dragnet.
These days, even when the sun is shining, a cloud hangs over the Devon Avenue neighborhood. Devon Avenue is a home away from home for tens of thousands of Pakistani immigrants, many of whom must meet the February 21st deadline to be fingerprinted, photographed, and interviewed by the Immigration and Naturalization Service downtown. Hundreds of Iranians were arrested in Los Angeles when they showed up to register in December. So even before the interviews began, community leaders like Raja Yaqub sprung into action to try and mitigate the impact on the Chicago Pakistani community.
Our goal is to organize the people about this issue. Secondly, if somebody is detained, to help them, to help their families in the shelters or homes, and legal help, like if he needs an attorney, how we can represent him. And if he is deported, if he needs a ticket for that, and he needs a shelter for that. And secondly, we can ask the congressmen or senators, like they should repeal this law, and the people should have their normal life again.
Yaqub emigrated from Pakistan 13 years ago. He's a United States citizen, a father of five, and owns several gasoline stations. Yaqub estimates that of the nearly 100,000 Pakistanis living in the area, 5,000 to 10,000 do not have legal status, and they're scared. He says the INS is unfairly targeting Muslims, and that the Bush administration's PR campaign has been insincere.
But now when the Pakistanis or Arabians or Muslim Arabians are, I mean, those people are being arrested or detained, definitely it will have a bad impact on that campaign. $15 million they are spending to, like, they have a good relation with the Muslim world. So I think the Bush administration saying one thing but practicing the different thing.
Sadruddin Noorani, a local Pakistani activist and businessman with strong political connections, takes a softer tone.
I do not oppose the law because, you know, it's a, you know, it's a safety and security of the nation. And when American people go out of the country, in most of the European country and Asian country, they have to register. My opposition is people will be going to register themselves and they will be arrested. So that's the opposition, and that's something that I have not been able to digest.
Noorani says that dozens of his neighbors have already fled to Canada to avoid the indignity of being arrested by the INS.
And in many cases, they are very honorable, respectful people with the family. Their kids are grown. They came here with toddlers, small kids, and their kids are grown up, and they don't want to see their parents, or wife does not want to see husband or son be handcuffed.
If Pakistanis in Chicago do find themselves in handcuffs, many will call Tahir Kameli, an immigration lawyer with offices right next door to the federal building where the interviews are being conducted. Kameli helped defend some of the Iranians arrested in Los Angeles, and he can't imagine the INS will catch any terrorists this way.
Imagine if a person wants to do something illegal or wants to hurt another individual or a country, they are not going to come into the INS and say, hey, INS, look at me, I'm here, let me register and sign and let you fingerprint me and take my picture, and whenever you want, I'll be at your service. Send me an email once in a while too. It just blows my mind.
Last week, Kameli met with the Pakistani ambassador. Kameli says the ambassador resents the selective nature of the registration process, considering Pakistan's high-profile role in the war on terrorism.
He's very dissatisfied with the whole procedure that is going on. They allowed the United States to use their land, basically, to when they were attacking Taliban. And now they feel betrayed with the fact that now their people are being targeted here in the United States as a person that may be terrorist, as a person that may harm the United States. I don't believe that the Pakistani government expected this kind of a treatment from the United States.
In Chicago, for Free Speech Radio News, this is Adam Satanidis.
Meanwhile, two South Asian men held in U.S. jails for more than a year in the crackdown following September 11 and now back in the southern Indian city of Hyderabad. Azmet Javed and Ayub Ali Khan were deported after being ultimately charged with credit card fraud. The two men now have to answer to Indian officials on charges of acquiring passports on the basis of false information. Both men have been granted bail and are now reunited with their families. But the relief of being back home is offset by the trauma they underwent in the U.S. Reporter Sputnik Kalambi caught up with one of the men in Hyderabad.
I had the dream, you know, that the States is the land of opportunity. I had the dream, you know, to build up myself and to support my family. That's the liberal and democratic country. But after September, the dreamland became hell for me.
The old city of Hyderabad has probably never looked as good. Potholes, noise, dirt and all. Ayub Ali Khan's face is gaunt and strained as he finally agrees to speak about the nightmare he and his friend Azmat went through in U.S. jails. A nightmare that began when they were arrested while traveling from New Jersey to Texas in search of employment soon after the terror strikes of September 11th. Accusing them of involvement in the attack on the World Trade Center, FBI officials tried everything in the book to make the charges stick, from financial rewards if they would plead guilty to death threats when they resisted. 54 days before they were finally given access to a lawyer, months before their families back at home were given any information, 11 months in solitary confinement before finally being charged on violating immigration rules, credit card fraud and deported.
11 months. Everybody knows the prolonged detention in the solitary confinement is the violation of the international convention or the international law. The U.S. government must know about that. It's like a psychological or mentally torture to me, sometimes physically too. I have no words to express the experiences which I had gone through. The food they used to give us, like, to, you know, to keep us alive, that much. And they used to come every half an hour in the initial months, bang the door, the make sure could not sleep day and night. The room size is 6x8 or 6x10. 23 hours I have to stay in the room, and 1 hour for the recreation with the shackles. I spent like 11 months in solitary confinement. I feel like, you know, I spent like 11 years.
More than their own personal traumas, it was the anguish their families suffered that Ayub Ali Khan finds unforgivable. He's still fearful when he goes out. He can't face people, he says, and has nightmares every night.
I'm trying to erase my experiences and trying to start a new life. I had a nightmare. It's already 1 month. I feel like a dead man just walking because of their mistake.
Ayub is surprisingly unbitter despite the last 16 months and is clear that his grouse is with the American government and not the American people. His thoughts, he says, are with the thousands of others like him still languishing in U.S. prisons. Meantime, he is determined to carry on with his life here.
Complete my law study in future, and I will try. I mean, if God permits me, a lot of poor people, they cannot afford lawyers. Inshallah, I will help them. I don't like to react the same way what the other people did to me. But, you know, I just, if they realize, you know, themselves that what they did, that was wrong, I feel happy. I don't want to take any kind of revenge or, you know, I don't want to get angry on them. This is not in my nature.
Ayub and his friend Azmat are out on bail pending a hearing on acquiring passports on the basis of false information. Civil rights activists say it's unlikely they will be punished further in India, though they might be given a token jail sentence. But even that, says Ayub, is palatable after his American nightmare. I'm Sputnik Kilambi in Hyderabad for Free Speech Radio News.
This is Free Speech Radio News. I'm Deepa Fernandez.